Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the autumn leaves are brightening up and the days are getting shorter. Time to start thinking about getting that first flu shot of the year. I guess there's only one you get,
there's
right?
There's only one for adults. That's the good news. And we are gearing up for that flu shot delivery in our own organization. And of course, all of those who work in healthcare are required or strongly encouraged to get their flu shots to really protect the patients, minimize any risk of transmission in the healthcare setting.
The CDC has launched a national campaign issuing a challenge for everyone to get their flu shot by the end of October. It takes a while for immunity to build up in the system, and flu strains change from year to year. So don't think if you received a flu shot last year that you're covered for this season.
And the CDC's Dr. Tom Frieden recently illustrated the importance of getting that flu vaccine, having his own delivered right during a press conference where he reminded people that flu is the most dangerous for people older than 65, for young children, pregnant women, and people with certain health conditions such as diabetes and lung disease and heart disease. And that encompasses just about everybody. So let's try and get everybody immunized.
Absolutely. And he really expressed some concern that many Americans just don't take influenza seriously enough. He called it the Rodney Dangerfield of diseases. It gets no respect. Flu sickens millions of Americans every year. And he says that if vaccination rates could be boosted by just 5% across the board, that would prevent 800,000 illnesses and nearly 10,000 hospitalizations that year alone.
Well, there is one slight change this year, Mark. The CDC has been tracking the effectiveness of the nasal spray vaccine. It's called FluMist, and it's been used by millions of children across the country. But an expert panel reported that it failed to protect children last year for the third year in a row and should not be used this coming flu season. CDC officials are worried it will reduce the number of children who receive their flu shots, but I think with education, we can probably counteract that.
The stats are pretty interesting, Margaret. About 50% of the nation's children got flu shots last year, and the percentage dropped significantly for 18 to 64-year-olds. And seniors are perhaps most vulnerable and are more likely to get their flu shots, about 70%.
So maybe we do get smarter as we get older. But we just can't say it enough. The only effective hedge against contracting the flu is to make sure that you and your family are vaccinated.
It's so interesting now, Margaret, that we can track all kinds of important health data digitally in real time. And it's something our guest has been thinking about for a long time. Dr. Charles Jaffe is the CEO of Health Level 7, the international organization dedicated to creating standards that support interoperability in health information technology. It's a complex topic, but it underlies everything we're trying to achieve with electronic health records and the growth of health IT.
Lori Robertson will also stop by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Charles Jaffe in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. After months of haggling, Congress found rare agreement on a funding measure approving $1.1 billion to combat the Zika virus in this country and leverage more research funds that will help those battling the epidemic around the world. Funding for Zika had been held up for months in spite of pleas from Dr. Tom Frieden of the CDC and Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Republican members of Congress had tried to embed measures in the funding that would have defunded Planned Parenthood. NIAID will get about $150 million of the money. Dr. Fauci's team actively working on a vaccine for the virus. The CDC will get about $350 million to fight Zika at home and abroad, and research will continue into Zika's pathology. Infections symptoms are generally mild but have posed significant threats to women who become infected during the first trimester of pregnancy. Thousands of such exposed infants have been born with a variety of birth defects. Health officials say the late appropriation of money to fight the virus delayed local surveillance programs, and they're bracing themselves for what might be an uptick in babies born with a signature birth defect, microcephaly, next spring. Flu season is nigh, and the CDC has urged Americans to get their flu vaccinations by the end of October to ensure the nation's population remains protected. Only about 50% of the nation's children will be vaccinated this year. There's been a growing anti-vaccination movement in recent years, hence the lower immunization rate for children. And a study out of the journal Pediatrics has looked at a link between choosing complementary or alternative treatments and the likelihood a child will be properly vaccinated. Some complementary medicine was shown to be quite common, according to the study. About 62% of kids take multivitamins or other supplements, and those children urged by non-traditional practitioners were less likely to get the vaccine and more likely to get sick during flu outbreaks, according to the study. However, behavior modification has been shown to have some efficacy, improving things like heart disease, whether it's losing weight, quitting smoking, or increasing exercise, or all three. Now the American Heart Association is asking Medicare to cover supervised exercise as a viable treatment to control heart disease. Citing numerous studies, the Heart Association urged CMS to support supervised exercise as a low-cost, non-invasive treatment option indicated for these patients. The proposed exercise would consist of a series of sessions lasting up to 60 minutes and involving use of either treadmill or track, each session supervised by an exercise physiologist or physical therapist. And folks suffering with type 1 diabetes can only improve their condition so much with diet and exercise. The FDA has approved the first automated insulin system for type 1 diabetes, Medtronic's MiniMed 670G hybrid closed-loop system. It's made up of an insulin pump and continuous glucose monitor, both of which are already on the market separately. The new part involves communication between the two devices. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Charles Jaffe, Chief Executive Officer of HL7, a nonprofit global organization seeking to create standards that support global health data interoperability. Dr. Jaffe was previously the Senior Global Strategist for the Digital Health Group at Intel Corporation, Vice President of Life Science at SAIC, and the Director of Medical Informatics at AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals. He also served as President of InfoMed. Dr. Jaffe has served in various leadership roles in the American Medical Informatics Association. He completed his medical training at Johns Hopkins and Duke Universities and was a postdoctoral fellow at the National Institute of Health. Dr. Jaffe, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here.
You know, Health Level 7, commonly known as HL7, founded 30 years ago to create this framework for sharing health data. And you have, I know, thousands of volunteers around the world working with you on this project. And it's emerged over these years as a leading organization for developing standards of health interoperability. I'd say the quest for interoperability remains very elusive, but most health practitioners, most people that matter, don't stop to think about the important work being done by your organization. And give us an overview of your organization's mission, as well as some of the shared goals at HL7.
HL7 has been delivering on a promise of health information exchange for three decades. We began as a small academic exercise and became embedded in regulation for countries around the world. There are some 50 countries that regularly use HL7, and it's safe to say that half of all healthcare data is exchanged on HL7 platforms. Much like the delicate and complicated technology behind an automobile ignition, you don't stop to think about standards and necessary components of an ignition when you start a car. And it should be the same for the underlying technology in a health information system. It should be doing its job and invisible to the people who need to use it. Part of the success of HL7 has been our ability to change as demands have changed. The key elements for most of the interoperability exchange really transcend technology itself and focus on the policies and other requirements that are so arcane. The United States has been successful in some of its interoperability. During the height of the Civil War, U.S. government mandated one gauge of railroad tracks so that the proprietary standards for rail travel didn't interfere with the seamless continuity of rail travel. The demands on the clinical community have increased exponentially. 20 years ago, there were four or five pieces of data that were needed for a physician to make a decision about a diagnosis or treatment. It's estimated that by the end of the decade, there will be 400 pieces of data and other information, including the explosion of the technology that will provide a great deal of the future of healthcare, whether it be genomics or proteomics. And we've kept pace with that.
Well, Dr. Jaffe, we have hundreds of languages spoken around the world, a wide array of internet standards. And I was actually not aware that HL7's mission relies on a coalition of thousands, literally thousands of volunteers. But I think our listeners would be fascinated to hear, how do you and your organization go about the work of creating standards that stakeholders can agree upon?
Part of the process is to understand the needs of the people that need to use the technology. The health systems themselves have a big responsibility in sharing health information. You can imagine the difficulty when one health system describes gender as M or F and another health system male or female. It's not as much of a challenge to English speakers, but to computers, it's a problem from the very go. So part of the critical effort we play is agreeing on vocabulary. In the world stage, there are multiple vocabularies. They need to be harmonized where the end user finds the information valid. So the different workflows and the different needs of a clinician also have to be understood. At HL7, we have an initiative that we call Partners in Interoperability, in which we bring clinicians, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, therapists, and try and understand what specifically that they require in their world of healthcare data. The reluctance of many physicians to adopt or utilize healthcare IT is based on antipathy they have toward a system which doesn't reflect their workflow. So we partner with the electronic health record vendors to be certain that they can support the kinds of data exchange and workflow requirements that the clinicians themselves require. And lastly, there are issues of disparate payment systems. For decades in the United States, claims reporting was an art form. Today, the authorities from Medicare and CMS have begun to examine the FHIR standard to obtain detailed clinical data that actually helps explain the intervention or diagnosis.
Well, you know, the holy grail seems to be true interoperability, and yet it doesn't seem like that is within our reach. I can go to my ATM anywhere in the world, and the standards, the ISO 8583 is used in banking. It's used in HL7. So what is it that allowed the banking people to get all of their definitions right?
Well, in the English language, there are 450,000 words. The National Library of Medicine has defined 2.7 million unique terms. So we're talking about orders of magnitude of greater complexity. If you have an understanding of what a heart attack is, I'm not sure two cardiologists would agree.
Well, then you paint a bleak picture for interoperability.
No, in fact, we're moving to a clearer understanding. When I was an intern, 4930 was the code for both asthma and bronchitis. We understand now that asthma isn't a disease. It's a physical finding in which we have bronchospasm and reactive airways. There are many diseases that we once coded as asthma, and we realize they're very different ailments.
Sure, and the ICD-11 has improved our communication, right? Our standardization.
ICD-11, it is so complex that it will take significant computer resources to be able to map the ontologies of that language. I met with two of the ICD leaders who will be discussing this with the WHO, but we partner with them as well so that the HL7 platform can support this very complex nomenclature. Mm-hmm. And although FHIR, Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources, is relatively new, it's captured the attention around the world, it's quite clear that it departs from the traditional messaging that HL7 and other standards have relied upon and uses the same technology upon which the internet relies. when you search for the best Italian restaurant in Connecticut, your search engine has not compiled a registry of restaurants. Instead, it looks for keywords in a host of databases and presents you with hundreds, if not more, choices that you can make. The buyer standard performs the same way as does the internet. It's also supported with authentication for patients, for security, with the same standards that are adopted in commerce on the internet, for much lower costs, with much greater facility and orders of magnitude shorter time frame. You can develop applications based on FHIR.
Honestly, from a clinical and quality point of view, we'd say ICD-10 was really a big step forward and helped us get a lot more precision and clarity, and also include some of the social determinants of health, which are a big concern to us. But I want to go back to interoperability. And why is it so hard to achieve interoperability down the street or between a primary care practice on Main Street and the specialist across town or the hospital? Still, we have trouble doing the essential function of care coordination for our patients. What's the missing piece of infrastructure in that scenario?
I think there are three levels of hurdle, all of which begin with the word policy. There are very few technical challenges that inhibit data exchange. There are health systems in California that are large, successful HMOs, and yet one site cannot share data with another. And that's related to the policies that have been defined by the physicians that lead those health practices. They have very different demands, and so they bring to bear those concepts when they implement their systems. HL7 doesn't write the software. We simply provide the infrastructure with which the software is written. There is far less antipathy amongst the big EHR vendors than you might suspect. At the Argonaut Project, which began in 2014, 14 healthcare organizations agreed to develop interoperability processes based upon FHIR. And to this day, 2 years later, we have the same 14 at the table, and whatever claims they make about the benefits, they're all selling their products based on features that are not conflicting at all. In fact, the Argonaut Project members have agreed to support phase 3 of, and will continue to do so. We see a level of collaboration that's belied by some in government, in particular in Congress, who say that information blocking begins with the EHR vendors. I hardly think so. Certainly, my experience with the Argonaut Project is about collaboration and agreement across the board. I think the future of sharing data down the street will be in policy terms, not in technical terms. I know only a few years ago, the two most wired hospitals in New York City were about a mile apart. And the best way to get data between them was to print it out and put it in a taxi.
That's right. Shout it down the street.
There's incentive now with our moving away from the perverse payment system, which was predicated on utilization, to a new payment model, which is focused on quality and outcomes. It'll be critical for entities to survive in that world without seamlessly exchanging data. There had been little or no incentive for health information exchanges, much less for two healthcare systems in the same city to share data. Now, their reimbursement will be dependent upon it. They will have shared risk, and they will have payment incentives to get it right.
We're speaking today with Dr. Charles Jaffe, Chief Executive Officer of HL7, the global standards organization seeking to create a platform for interoperability in health information technology around the world. You know, Dr. Jaffe, I wanted to pick up on the word policy. You've been working with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid and standardizing things like billing and quality, and also working with FDA and the Veterans Administration. So these are really policymakers. Tell me how that's moving along in terms of the agenda that you have of getting the policymakers to align their thinking with the rest of the world, but how are those larger policymaking institutions working?
Well, I think one of the big challenges that we face in the United States is we don't have a uniform patient identification number.
Mm-hmm.
In Southern California, Kaiser, there are 10,000 Maria Gonzalez. probabilistic patient matching is insufficient.
Right.
In your credit report, there's an inherent 5% error rate. You go fight with the credit company, and you'll possibly reconcile it. But when there's wrong data in the medical record and decisions are made predicated on that incorrect data, then there are serious outcomes. And we support the efforts of the various healthcare organizations that are focusing on changing the policy that's mandated by U.S. legislation that prohibits the use of a patient identifier. So we can improve quality by one order of magnitude by increasing the certainty that we're talking about the same patient. So that's a policy issue that needs to be addressed more quickly. I can envision a day when the cost of a complete DNA profile is available to everyone. Mm-hmm. And then we can use our DNA signature as our patient ID. But until that happens, we have to rely on the kinds of technology that we have available. And that'll only be achieved when the policy changes. There are other policy issues, such as the regulations around HIPAA. HIPAA specifically allows exchange of data for research. It's often used as a weapon to prevent the exchange of data. Secondly, U.S. Privacy laws that are mandated through HIPAA, which were about not about privacy, but became the stigma for sharing information. Mm-hmm. The federal laws are the baseline. State and local laws supervene HIPAA. Until we get a uniform code around which we're permitted to share data, we won't be successful. We shouldn't have to have a team of lawyers to tell us whether we can send information from one New York hospital to another. And all of the other non-clinical requirements that are built into a regulation built by someone who never took care of a patient.
Well said.
And lastly, there are issues around clinical quality. In my medical society, I'm required to take 50 hours of continuing education a year. I remember at my graduation when I was told that if I read an entire journal every night, at the end of a year, I'd only be a year behind. Huh. I've heard that estimate is now revised, and I'd be 10 years behind. The key to overcoming that barrier is clinical decision support. But the reality is that if the predictions, the advancement in science are correct, and we do have 400 data points to analyze at the end of the decade before we make a clinical decision, we'll never do it without a robust clinical decision support tool. Today in the United States, there will be tens of thousands of prescriptions for an antibiotic for strep throat in an adult that are absolutely inappropriate, that have no justification, and yet they'll be gladly accepted by the patients who rely on the clinicians for their care. We need the clinical decision support to overcome the quality gaps that are inherent in the old care model, in which the physician could somehow assimilate all of the evidence and all the knowledge about diagnosis and treatment without the aid of the kinds of computer tools that are now available. The physician community soon will be subject to the same kinds of quality requirements that airplane pilots are, to check the system, to have a set of redundancies and other system validation. So we won't be prone to the many misadventures that we are inevitably inclined to do because we're acting out of too few resources and too little guidance.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Charles Jaffe, CEO of HL7, a nonprofit global organization seeking to create standards that support global health data interoperability. You can learn more about their work by going to hl7.org or follow them on Twitter at HL7News. Dr. Jaffe, thank you so much for the incredible work that you are doing and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has been making false and misleading claims about the proposed premiums for 2017 on the Affordable Care Act exchanges. The claims are part of Trump's stump speeches made in campaign rallies. He says that your premiums are through the roof, citing high proposed rate increases for some exchange plans of 50 and 60%. Most insured Americans get their coverage through employers, where premiums have been rising at historically low rates for the past several years. But 7% of the U.S. population buys their own insurance on the individual market, such as through the exchanges. And indeed, some insurers have requested rate increases for 2017 exchange premiums above 50%. Any increase above 10% has to be approved by government regulators for the next open enrollment period, which begins November 1st. But the high increases could be outliers. The Kaiser Family Foundation analyzed preliminary rates in cities in 16 states in Washington, D.C., and found the second lowest cost Silver plan would increase by a weighted average of 9% from this year if the rates hold. That varies widely from a drop of 13% in Providence, Rhode Island, to a hike of 25% in Nashville. For 2016, the increase was only 2% for those areas, and experts do believe exchange premiums will rise more this year than they have in the past. However, 80% of those buying exchange plans get federal subsidies, which lower premium contributions to a percentage of their income. Trump further claims that the Obama administration wants to delay the November 1 start date of open enrollment until after the election because of the premium increases. But the Trump campaign offered no proof of that to the Washington Post fact checker. The Department of Health and Human Services said in a statement that the open enrollment dates are the same as this past year and, quote, won't be moved. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Sub-Saharan Africa leads the world in maternal and infant deaths each year. According to an annual report from Save the Children, an estimated 397,000 babies died at birth in that region in 2013, and some 550 mothers died per day as well. Most of the causes have to do with lack of access to medical care in these low-resource regions, and often the local midwives lack formal medical training to prepare them to conduct interventions in the event of a life-threatening event like a hemorrhage or an infection.
We know that 90% of all the deaths that we see today could be prevented if the mother had access to this, really basic skilled care during the childbirth.
Anna Frelin is CEO of the Maternity Foundation, a Copenhagen-based nonprofit dedicated to eliminating maternal and infant death in the world. Their organization has created an intervention for midwives living in low-resource areas if they just have access to a smartphone. It's called the Safe Delivery App, and it provides comprehensive training for midwives that teach them and guide them on what to do in the event of a birthing crisis.
This is really a matter of building the skills of the health workers who are already out there and empower them to be able to better handle the emergencies that, may occur during a childbirth, such as, the woman starts bleeding or the newborn is not breathing and so forth. So first and foremost, it's a matter of finding a way that we can reach the health workers and build their skills.
Frelin says the real promise of the Safe Delivery application lies in its ability to provide ongoing obstetric and neonatal training so that local midwives can gain important clinical knowledge over time. The Safe Delivery app has been designed to be culturally relevant and easily understood, and it's received the United Nations approval for wider deployment. The Maternity Foundation plans to have the Safe Delivery app in the hands of 10,000 healthcare workers across the region by next year, potentially impacting a million live births. A low-cost, culturally sensitive mobile app that offers immediate guidance and assistance to midwives and health workers, the backbone of the healthcare system in low-resource areas, empowering them with ongoing support and knowledge that can improve birth outcomes, Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.